June 14th. Appreciate the committee being here for the early morning version. We will go till 10 o'clock this morning and then adjourn until 1:15. And we will pick up where we left off yesterday, which was in the Section 12, Waiver Use and Transferability. And I'll ask Glenn Klein, Lane Cheddarly, and Bob Stacey to come forward. And I don't see anyone representing OIA here yet this morning, so.
Probably don't.
In the room.
Depending where the crowd is.
And committee, we have been informed that the new amended Dash 3 amendments are still not ready yet. So hopefully sometime today, if we can get them. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor.
And Sam, can you do you have a where we kind of left off in Section 12 yesterday?
Well, actually, you had had a description of Section 12 and also in a little bit into Section 13. So you had covered about the issue of the waivers and the topic of their transferability for 10 years and two years after the point that their property is transferred. I think there was this was near the end of the meeting when this topic came up, so it might be appropriate to have a recap by Mr. Klein about the summation, because I think one of the things that I had a note that in Section 13 the panel had there was quite a bit of discussion about the how that works with the 10 years after date of final decision, and I think the panel had felt or indicated that there could be some clarification that they would want to look at some of that wording. So perhaps from yesterday's meeting to today, Mr. Klein has had some time to review that, if that does need to be tweaked or not.
There are also two issues, Mr. Chairman, on this. I mean, the issue is, if we're doing nothing but clarifying the language of Measure 37, it seems to me this is a rather significant expansion, and we ought to make sure we have that on the forefront. And the notion of essentially having waivers that could last as long as perpetuity, as long as the family doesn't transfer it, is a significant expansion, it seems to me, of 37.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, just to remind the chair, indelibly, in my memory is the recollection that I had my hand up and the chair's.
Ah, yes.
We'll continue with you, Mr. Stacey, tomorrow morning, but you don't have to go in that order.
But thank you for the reminder. That was very appropriate. And committee, I was reminded this morning, too, that the Dash 3s that we're looking at and the amended ones were crafted with a balance involving the cities, counties, and most of the entities involved, and that the more we tinker, changing here and there, the more risk we have of losing somebody along the way, which we don't want to do. And committee, there's no question that the issue we're on now, that Representative Greenlick referred to, is one of the major issues that we need to solve in this bill in order to get it to the governor's desk. So, Bob, I'll let you lead off. See?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob Stacey, 1000 Friends of Oregon. And just as a point of clarification, I greatly appreciate the courtesy of the chair in asking me to sit here at the witness table, both during yesterday's briefing and walkthrough and this morning. 1000 Friends of Oregon, whom I represent, is not one of those who participated in the development of the Dash 3s. We've already been left behind, using the terminology of the chair, and we're scrambling to jump on board the wagon as it rolls down the path. From time to time, such as on this point, with the indulgence of the committee, I simply wish to raise questions that, if resolved appropriately, could enable us to clamber on board as well. And one of those is in Section 13. This is a pretty fundamental question. How much certainty should be provided to the landowners who obtain waivers under Measure 37 and Measure 37 as amended by the Legislative Assembly? There's a great deal to be said for certainty, and the more that we can provide to all parties, the better. There's also a great deal to be said for ensuring that everybody affected by a waiver decision has certainty and repose, particularly if there's a long period of time following the granting of a waiver with no action on that waiver. Uncertainty and anxiety about the possible consequences of future development at a time that the neighbors can't be sure of begins to build on the part of surrounding farm, forest, or other land users. If we assume that Measure 37 is a permanent change in our land use laws, then perhaps that's a level of uncertainty that those property owners will have to deal with. I believe, and this is a controversial point, I believe that land use law, like many other public policy issues, is a pendulum. The pendulum has swung way over. I would argue the weight came loose and fell off. It swung so far. Nonetheless, I believe the pendulum will swing back, and that at some point in the future, perhaps the not distant future, property owners, neighbors, voters who are concerned about the effects of some development under land use waivers may come to expect changes in those laws. I think this committee and the Legislative Assembly should exercise some caution in attempting to give assurances to property owners that not only for 10 years, but for an indeterminate time, essentially as long as the life of the current claim holder, a claim can be held without being acted upon because a future Legislative Assembly may not uphold that promise. Given the swing of the pendulum, we would suggest that instead of saying 10 years or a longer period if there is no transfer and 2 years following a transfer, you change that word in section 13-1 that now says later and make it earlier. The earlier of 10 years after the date of the final decision or 2 years after a transfer. That gives a great deal of certainty to any property owner who wishes to continue to farm, engage in forest production, that for the next 10 years they can pursue those objectives or the current use of the land, whatever it is, secure in the knowledge that they can exercise their rights and transfer the property or develop the property. And that, of course, if the property is transferred at any time, there would be 2 years for the subsequent purchaser to vest the use. For very similar reasons, we would suggest that subsection A under paragraph A under subsection 2 of that same section be eliminated. That's the paragraph that begins, for a land division, the recordation of a final partition or final subdivision plat. This is the section that defines successfully implemented the level of development or activity which has to be undertaken in order to vest the claim. And again, if a property owner is enabled to wait 25, 30, 35 years for filing a subdivision plat and then does nothing else but get platting of a subdivision and the land is still not developed, this now reads in a way that suggests that a future developer of that subdivision could rely on the creation of the parcels and the intended uses at the time of the creation of the parcels to develop. In fact, we've already gone through several changes of land use policy in which old platted subdivisions from generations before have been reused for other purposes, most significantly agriculture and forestry. Trying to ensure that a subdivision approved 30 years ago and not to be developed for another 10 or 20 should be permitted over a 50-year period to lock in a particular development decision, I think goes beyond the realistic expectations of the legislature or of the people. So, again, we would change later to earlier in Section 13, Subsection 1, and we would eliminate Paragraph A of Subsection 2 so that to be substantially implemented would mean to vest by beginning development of the waiver. I'd be glad to answer any questions about the issue.
Committee, any questions for Mr. Stacey? Representative Anderson.
By doing this, you're basically forcing the development up front. wouldn't it in some ways be better to let it happen over a longer period of time and let more farmland stay farmland?
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Anderson, this is a trade-off. On the one hand, the repose or certainty that all property owners will realize when there's a relatively short period of time within which the waiver must be exercised. And on the other side is the concern that there may be property owners who wish to continue to use their land for agriculture or forest uses. Given the balance of equities, I believe that a shorter time period, but one as generous as a decade, is a pretty good compromise, leaving it open-ended. While beneficial in those limited circumstances where agriculture could continue on that parcel, breeds a great deal of uncertainty in the surrounding neighbors who have to decide whether they're going to continue to invest in their agricultural operations, install drainage, install irrigation, make other investments, and not knowing what extent of development is going to occur when will have a big impact on them as well.
Any other questions, Representative Ackerman?
Yes, could you suggest any other tests other than the recordation of the final partition or final subdivision? I understand your point that they could just do that and then this thing just hangs out and over a very, very long period of time. But I'm also concerned about the folks that would be developing and be in the middle of the development process when the waiver expires. I was wondering if there's any other more logical or workable benchmarks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I believe that, well, you know, no set of judicial precedents is always crystal clear. The development of the law of vesting in Oregon, as well as nationally, has given some pretty good benchmarks to property owners about what level of investment is going to be necessary to lock in your rights. Making an investment based upon a land use approval, turning dirt, beginning the installation of facilities, in many cases has been held to be a significant enough expenditure to vest a right to complete the development, even though regulations change in the meantime. And Oregon is one such state that recognizes those kinds of specific investments in a development activity in reliance on an approval as vesting a right to complete the development. So I think you can look to the case law, which is, you know, triggered by this word vested, to get pretty clear guidance.
I was looking to something more specific, such as the issuance of a building permit or something more more definite, rather than just the recordation of a final partition, which I agree kind of doesn't mean anything unless you implement it. But can you come up with any other benchmarks that might be more definitive?
Even the issuance of a building, Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, the issuance of a building permit would be a more substantial step in reliance on a subdivision plat than mere recordation, and that could be a substitute. But I believe vesting is the best test, because in fact it's broader. In some cases, prior to the issuance of a building permit, it may be possible to vest the right to complete development based upon the kinds of expenditures for infrastructure in a subdivision.
I understand that concept, but I'm having a hard time weaving that into a legislative language. But I guess we consider that at a later time. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I heard you say that you hated to see any of these things locked in for quite a period of time. Is that accurate? My reason for asking is that it seems to me that's what Senate Bill 100 did. It locked in EFU use permanently, and yet you're asking us not to lock in the right that these people under Measure 37 were kept from having.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Anderson, I would only submit that EFU is not locked in permanently, and that both because of the process of urban growth boundary expansion, because of the process of exceptions under the statewide planning goals by which a county can designate agricultural or other resource land for needed uses, because of processes created by the Legislative Assembly, such as the Destination Resort process, and because of the Legislative Assembly's and LCDC's work to continuously refine the kinds of uses that are permitted in the exclusive farm use zone. Exclusive farm use zoning itself is not a permanent decision. In fact, the passage of Measure 37 and the issuance of waivers affecting agricultural land is itself a change to that agricultural land designation, which shows its impermanence. I merely suggest that even as this Legislative Assembly and its predecessors have changed the details of land use law in response to public concern, those changes may, if you will, go in the other direction in the future, arising out of concerns about the impact of development by some under waivers, and that there will be a need by the Legislative Assembly to trim back some of those impacts. If that is the case, it would have been unfortunate to give an open-ended assurance to property owners in this legislative session that they could hold a waiver right for their entire lifetimes without transferring it, free of any interference.
Mr. Klein, Mr. Shetterly, do you have a comment on Mr. Stacy's?
Oh, I'm being called on.
I can flip a coin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I guess what I would say is that I am probably one of a perhaps declining number who still advocate for the substantial construct that is reflected in the June 8th amendments that you're looking at here, understanding that, you, as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, these were negotiated by a group that, while it was not all-inclusive, did represent a substantial spectrum from Oregonians in Action to cities, counties, metro, home builders, and the governor's office and the department. And this is one of those. There are puts and takes all through here, and transferability is in here and is balanced to some extent by other considerations such as the rural lands and urban growth boundary provisions that are in the bill, with the idea in mind, I think, as the group put this together, that like many legislative compromises, there would be elements in this bill that everybody could look at and say, I don't like, but that in the total there would be enough that we could perhaps draw enough members to support the total package to move it through, which is the ultimate objective here. So I wouldn't advocate at this point making any discrete changes to this section, simply because, again, recognizing that I was before you last week in presenting this as what I said was a 93% agreed upon package, and I think Mr. Honeycutt corrected me and said 98%. I don't feel like I'm in a position of deconstructing this myself, having been part of the construction of it, so I would not make any substantial changes in the waiver and transferability section.
Glenn, do you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Glenn Klein with Harang Long. My only comment would be the same as Lane's. There were a lot of discussions about the scope of what people should be able to file claims for, which was something that the governmental entities in the work group were really concerned about. And on the flip side, a big concern from Dave Honeycutt and John Chandler on making sure that when somebody does get a waiver for one of those areas within the scope, the more limited scope, that waiver would be useful for a long period of time and would not force, in particular, a farmer to have to stop farming in order to take advantage of the waiver. And so that's the reason why it was written the way it was. As Lane said, this section is, at least in the work group's mind, very much tied to Section 14 on the retro claims inside the urban growth boundaries, on Section 17 and 18 on what happens in the rural areas, as well as on the definition of land use regulation, which in the new measure, if you will, is slightly different than Measure 37's definition, and in part it opened up some things that weren't in Measure 37. So those were all part of a package, and so I agree with Lane that I'm not in a position to say, oh yeah, go ahead and start making changes similar to what Mr. Stacy said, simply because that would then start unraveling other parts of the package as we viewed it.
Mr. Chair, could I comment, please?
Representative Green.
Thank you, sir. I do want to point out that while there's some agreement among this work group, it's a pretty narrow work group. I mean, the work group represented essentially the government, Oregonians in Action, and the home builders. And while I trust the government is here to help us, and we all have a lot of confidence in how well our government's subunits have done, these parties all have one particular point, one particular thrust, and that's to create certainty rather than to create appropriateness. And to a certain extent, I mean, when we're talking to Farm Bureau and to others, and we haven't heard from Farm Bureau yet, but I assume we're going to hear from them soon, they have a perspective of including both certainty and a rather narrow rather than a rather broad interpretation of Measure 37. We're in this narrow, broad interpretation issue here. And while I do care about the notion of keeping that narrow coalition of folks together that produced minor -3, I think we have more objectives in this committee to worry about than whether Metro can continue to agree with the League of Cities and DLCD. I like it when Metro and League of Cities and DLCD all get together, but I don't consider that a very important objective.
Mr. Tucker's ears must have been burning out in the hall.
Well, we all love Metro, and we have a lot of concern for them.
Representative Ackman.
Yes, did the work group consider any other alternatives but that which is set forth here on the duration of the waivers? And if so, could you let us know what those were?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, we talked about a number of different things, including whether it should be the earlier of or the later of. In terms of the actual numbers that were chosen, 10 years and 2 years, there was nothing magical about those particular numbers. They were ones that, in the context of the other conversations we were having, felt right. When it got down to subsection 2 and what constitutes substantially implemented, there was not a lot of discussion by the work group other than to make sure that what we came up with was something that would not result in some kind of gotcha down the road so that somebody got what they thought was a waiver and then that waiver simply vanished. One of the other tests, if you will, for substantially implemented for a subdivision or partition that I had played with at one point, and I think it was me, and I don't even remember if I talked about this with any other member of the work group, was rather than to say the recordation of a final plat or final subdivision, you could say the installation of the infrastructure, or at least spell out which infrastructure you're talking about, but the installation of the roads and sewers and water pipes to serve the subdivision. Then at least you know that there is more than the mere recording of a piece of paper, that there is that type of substantial investment, that the developer said, okay, I actually am going to do something with this property, because once they expend the money for that infrastructure, they're not going to sit on it for the next 20 or 30 or 40 years. That notion, however, is also captured in the sub B, which is the vesting concept that Mr. Stacey was talking about. So the language that you have here, I believe, is sort of the, at least in terms of the sub two, is a better package than tying it to infrastructure. But if you wanted something different than simply the recording of it, then the installation of infrastructure would be one possibility.
Thank you. Follow on. Did you consider, however, that the mere recordation of the final partition or final subdivision could have the long-term consequence of granting the waiver in perpetuity?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I certainly was aware of that. There was not a lot of discussion among the work group about that concept. The work group said, okay, how are we going to deal with this? There was far more discussion about the subsection 1 and then the technicians meaning me, Richard Whitman, Dan Olson, said, okay, now how do we have something clear for sub 2? This is what we proposed, and when the rest of the work group saw that language, they said, yeah, that looks fine. So it was not a significant conversation in terms of what goes into sub 2.
Thank you. Mr. Klein, with the Department of Justice's earlier position in regard to the transferability, did they give this any kind of sign of approval or disapproval as it was being put together?
Mr. Chair, Richard Whitman from the Department of Justice has been involved in the drafting of this. I told the committee before this wasn't my product. It's been a joint product, and it really has been. I haven't asked Mr. Whitman whether any of this is somehow tied up in the prior opinion, and perhaps this is a question I should defer to Lane, but sort of the way I view it is what the Department of Justice opined on with respect to transferability was based on the existing Measure 37. This language would be replacing that language, and so that prior opinion that was looking at what did the prior language mean wouldn't have any effect on what this means. This is intended to, in a sense, replace that and make clear what is ambiguous now.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Thank you very much. We are, if this committee had a lot of time, and obviously asked Bob and the other parties to get together and try to find some common ground, but we're not given that luxury of time at this point. So, Mr. Stacy, I'm going to have to ask you a very direct question at this point, and that is, how negotiable are you in this area?
Mr. Chair, Bob Stacy, I, for one thing, certainly do not want to create gotchas to capture people who thought they had a waiver but then are unable actually to use it. And I appreciate and understand what Mr. Klein means about having some reference to subdivision. In the interest of aiding the committee, I would agree on the spot to the suggestion that Mr. Klein made that the addition of a reference to investment in infrastructure, completion of the infrastructure necessary to serve the lots in the subdivision, together with recordation of the plat, would be a sufficient nod to certainty for the neighbors, for the property owner, to enable that waiver to continue. We would continue to argue that a decade is enough time for a landowner to decide to exercise the waiver right itself.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could add that suggestion about the changing the infrastructure is not one that anybody in the work group has said, yeah, that would also be okay. You know, here are two alternatives. Klein, go choose one. And so before, I don't want the committee to think that by my suggesting that other members of the work group, in particular Dave Honeycutter, John Chandler, would support that. And I was just looking, and Dave's not here. But I want you to know that he has certainly not bought up on that concept, and I don't know about John Chandler.
I think what the chair would like to do at this point, in that we will be reconvening at 1:15 this afternoon, that perhaps you'd have an opportunity to contact those parties and see whether there is an agreement of some kind in this area. Is that acceptable to the parties? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd also like to note for the record, in response to your question about DOJ, it seems to me the answer was that the Attorney General's opinion was that there was not transferability in Measure 37 as it's written. There is transferability in this language as it's written, and therefore this language is a clear expansion of Measure 37 rather than a clarification of it.
I think it,
by that interpretation.
I'll disagree with you in the respect that I believe we are clarifying the intent of Measure 37.
Right.
I think we've had testimony before this committee for 5 months indicating that most of the people who voted for Measure 37 felt there was transferability.
well, we were about a million short of asking the people who voted for Measure 37 as to what their intent was. We did talk to people who had a claim under Measure 37, and they told us what their intent was. It seems to me all I'm suggesting is that, at least in the Attorney General's opinion, this would be an expansion based on that opinion, and that I don't think it's humanly possible for us to clarify intent. I think it's possible for us to clarify words so that we can create our own version of what the intent was. But I think it's
we're not trying to change the intent. We are attempting to interpret the intent.
I really don't think that's a feasible thing to do. I think what we're doing is changing the words.
So you think that everyone who voted for Measure 37 knew that there wasn't transferability?
I don't think that 97.5% of the people that voted for Measure 37 thought about transferability as an issue. I don't believe they came with a clear intent on Measure 37 and said, here's what it means. It means we can transfer things up to 10 years, we can hold it in our property, we can get either money or rights. I don't think there was anything, I mean, I've studied political theory and political behavior for 35 and 40 years, and I know people vote on a measure for a variety of reasons. I also know in this body, we've been attempting to clarify intent in a direction that suits our interests in Measure 37, and for example, in Measure 3, we had an exercise just last week where instead of clarifying the intent of the voters, which was clearly a particular intent, we said, well, let's substitute our own intent for that. And I think we're in the danger of doing the same thing here. So I think the notion that somehow we're on a holy mission to make sure the intent of those million people that voted gets implemented is just folly. I think we're doing, what we're trying to do is to substitute our own version. Maybe 7 of us, or maybe 60 of us, or maybe 91 of us, but the fact is, the sense that we're trying to figure out what was in their mind when they voted for Measure 37 and give it to them, frankly, just doesn't make any sense to me at all.
So I just want to make sure I'm understanding what you're saying. You're saying that the people who voted for Measure 37 did not anticipate that they could sell that property.
I'm saying most of the people, that the million people that voted for Measure 37, had no property to sell under Measure 37. The people we've talked to here did have claims and things they wanted to set, but there are not a million claims coming in. So there were over a million people who voted for Measure 37, and they voted for it, as the study showed, for a lot of interesting reasons. Because they somehow wanted government to be fair, because they somehow wanted government to compensate. There were probably dozens or hundreds of different reasons why people voted for Measure 37. You know why you voted for it. Patty knows why she voted for it. Mm-hmm. Representative Anderson knows why he voted for it. I mean, and I know why I voted against it. Frankly, when I voted against it, it never occurred to me that it was going in perpetuity, even though there were a bunch of words. I was thinking about this was about redressing past injustices, and how do we do something about dealing with those? So, I mean, I'm probably not the most naive voter, but when I thought about what I was voting for, and I heard Honeycutt talk 6 times, some of these things never, ever came up in the discussions. Sometimes they did. But let's not fool ourselves. What we're doing is we're substituting, on a political basis, our understanding or our desire for what Measure 37 ought to be, and that's okay to do. This is not a constitutional amendment. This is I think that's the point Bob was making. This is a statutory initiative. So we can change it. We can change it this year. We can change it 2 years from now. We can change it 4 years from now. I mean, we can change it. But let's not fool ourselves, it seems to me, in what we're doing. And trying to have this Ouija board that tells us what the voters really meant, did it mean sooner than 10 years or later than 10 years? Come on. I mean, we're just trying to achieve some political compromise on how to settle this thing. Because it is an ambiguous thing. I'm sorry, it's early in the morning and it hasn't been a great morning, so I'm carrying on. But I think if our real intention is to do nothing but clarify, not to expand, and not to guess what the voters wanted, then I think we're pushing transferability. This is what's triggered it. This mile pushes transferability far beyond what I think it ought to be pushed.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that the voters voted, maybe they didn't have clearly in their mind every little facet of transferability. But I think we're limiting this because if I read what I saw out there, it was that you could do now what you could have done in 1968 or 1940 or 1920, that you had the right to go ahead and do the things you wanted to do now.
That's what you said. You can do it now.
No.
Representative,
no.
Let's let Representative Anderson finish before he's in.
You could do now what you could have done in 1968. And there was no limit on it at that time. Now, I think on the second point that I'd like to make, and I want to keep it short because we've got a lot to cover, and I'm not here to philosophize at this point, but we have a team here who represents 36 counties, who represents more than 150 cities. We have some very good legal minds. We have the director of DLCD. I think we have a very, very good statewide representation of what should be done, and I feel very comfortable leaving it in their hands and taking those guidelines as we move forward.
Any other comments?
Yes, if I may just comment. Representative Anderson said people voted that you could do now what you could have done 30 years ago. Even if we accept that, and let me accept that for a moment, they didn't say you could do 30 years from now what you could do 30 years ago. That is a very different statement between being able to do now and what this section writes into perpetuity. And I don't think there's any voter that thought this, that what you could do 30 years ago, you'll be able to do 30 years from now. And that's what Measure 13 is saying.
Representative Anderson.
Doesn't say you couldn't. I think we need to move on.
What we will do, we certainly have identified this as an area that it was the chair's intention that we go through, indicate the areas this first time through the dash 3 to, in essence, spotlight the areas that we did need to concentrate and work on. When it comes to the second go around through these amendments, and hopefully we'll have the final version of those dash threes by then, that's when, if necessary, this committee will vote on each and every one of those issues, and each member will be able to demonstrate their feelings about what the end product will be. So I think Representative Greenlick has identified this as an area that he has concerns with, as has Representative Anderson, and hopefully by tomorrow when we start the second round, again, we'll have to decide, the committee will decide as to the language in Section 13. So we will move on. Is there any other area of this section, Glenn, that you want to address other than 1A and B, and 2A, I guess, and 2B.
No, Mr. Chair, there's nothing else I'd have to offer on Section 13.
Okay. And we move on to Section 14, Urban Growth Boundaries. Would you like to give us the overview on this?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Section 14, as I mentioned just a moment ago, was, in a sense, at least part of the quid pro quo from the government's perspective on the Section 13 on transferability. What Section 14 would do, it deals only with claims filed inside urban growth boundaries, and it relates only to claims based on regulations that exist as of the effective date of this measure. So let's assume that this measure goes into effect on August 1st. Section 14 would only deal with regulations that were in effect, that had been adopted as of August 1st, 2005. So that's, in a sense, the scope of this. What it does is to say that in order for somebody to have a claim inside the urban growth boundary based on one of those existing regulations, that the claim would have to relate to a residential use of property, that it would have to also relate to a land use regulation that is either a Goal 5 protection measure, which is what sub 1 deals with in section 14, or if the regulation wasn't adopted as a Goal 5 protection measure but is something similar, then one of those. And the way we describe that is in sub 2, that the regulation, although not adopted as a protection measure under Goal 5, that the regulation limits the developable area based on aesthetics, environmental, or natural qualities. And so what that's intended to pick up would be a regulation that says we have these really nice hillsides and we want to try to protect those hillsides, so we're not going to allow a lot of development up there. Might be based in part on concerns related to safety, but might also be based in part on nothing more than the aesthetics of people living on the, in a sense, the valley floor wanting a nice hillside. So this is intended to pick up the app. The second sentence of subsection 2 is just to make clear that when we're talking about regulations limiting the developable area, we're not talking about a design review code, that nobody in the work group thought it was necessary to make or to offer Measure 37 claim for a design review code. So that's why the second sentence is added.
Any questions?
I have a question.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just a question generally. Was this any of this in Measure 37?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, none of this was in Measure 37.
So this is an expansion?
This would be something that was not in Measure 37.
Thank you.
Is this a compromise piece for any other piece in these dash three?
Mr. Chair, this is, as my initial comments mentioned, this is very much tied to the local government saying that we would support transferability, which in our mind, and I'll be one of the first to admit that in my mind it's unclear as to whether Measure 37 authorizes transferability, and that's what I've said to my city councils, but what this would do is guarantee transferability, and for the cities, and I think this is true for counties as well, that this is that quid pro quo. We guarantee transferability, but the claims inside urban growth boundaries would be limited to this.
Mr. Stacey.
Mr. Chair, in response to Representative Smith's question, which was not directed to me, but which I hope I'll be indulged and answer. 1000 Friends of Oregon has not proposed a change similar to this. It is a change. It's a limitation on claims that are valid under Measure 37. It eliminates a large number of claims that Measure 37 created. It treats claim holders inside urban growth boundaries, except in the narrow instance of a Goal 5 regulation, as having no rights, taking the Measure 37 rights away from them. And by implication, it treats neighbors inside urban growth boundaries as having more protection than farmers outside urban growth boundaries from the impacts of waivers. We could not support that kind of differentiation. I live in a city. I live in a single-family zone neighborhood. One of my neighbors is entitled, under Measure 37, to replace her single-family home. She's a widow. She's owned it since the early 50s. With the multifamily development, if she so chooses, on her double lot under Measure 37. This takes away her right. This gives me more protection than it gives a farmer in an EFU zone next to a waiver. We would not ask for this kind of special treatment.
Thank you.
Representative Smith. One more question. Thank you, sure, Mr. Not. Chair. And maybe either one, anyone can answer this. What do you mean restricts the residential use of residentially zoned land? Is that a specific zone designation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, that means that the land that the property owner owns would be zoned residential. It could be single family, it could be multifamily, but it would have some sort of residential zone as opposed to a commercial zone or an industrial zone. And then second, the use that the property owner would want to put to the property under the waiver would be a residential use as opposed to a commercial or industrial use.
So follow up.
Oh.
So this is aimed at residential people with inside the urban growth boundary.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, that's correct. This is intended to make sure that people would be able to develop their property for residential purposes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I have two questions. What would it mean if that said restricts any use of residentially zoned property as opposed to residential use? And does this mean that you could have a claim under this language for a shopping center in a residentially zoned land?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, unless the regulation restricts the residential use, then you would not have a claim under the way this is drafted, because the claim would have to be, you would have to be asking for a residential use. If you were asking for a commercial use, a shopping center, then you wouldn't have a claim under this section.
So you, if I may follow, so you could make, this does, this would not restrict me from making a claim for a shopping center in residentially zoned land if the zoning came after I owned the land in the first place. Under this, it would not stop me. I could come in. At his neighbor could ask for, instead of a multi-family apartment, could ask for a shopping center, and that would not be stopped under this section. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, that is not correct.
Okay.
This would not allow you to make a claim for a shopping center. You could only make a claim if what you wanted to do was to have a residential use. If what you wanted to do was to have a commercial or industrial use, you would not have a claim based on any existing regulation. So the way this is written is you can only file a Measure 37 claim for an existing regulation if what you want is a residential use, if the property that you own is zoned residential, and if the regulation that you're complaining about is either a Goal 5 protection measure or something that's not Goal 5 but falls into that sub 2. But you would have to meet each of those in order to have a claim.
Well, let me follow, because all I have in front of me is the words rather than all your deliberation. It says, I may not file a claim for a land use regulation made before unless the land use regulation restricts the residential use. So that means I could file a claim for anything that doesn't restrict the residential use of residentially zoned property. Is that not right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, that's certainly not what's intended, and I don't think that's what it says. What it says is that you may not file a claim that was enacted before the effective date. So you can't file any claim based on an existing regulation unless the regulation restricts the residential use. If what you're dealing with is a regulation which restricts the commercial use, you can't file a claim, because this says you may not file any claim unless the regulation you're talking about restricts the residential use.
So this says no claims may be filed under Measure 37 inside the urban growth boundary except for a regulation that restricts the residential use and restricts it on the basis of sub 1 and sub 2. Other than that, there can be no claims filed inside urban growth boundary. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, that's correct for regulations that exist as of the effective date. That's not true prospectively. But otherwise, with that caveat, yes, that's what it says.
Mr. Gallagher, would you... Bob, if you'll just trade with him just for a moment here.
Don't steal any of those secrets.
That's right.
Mr. Chair, quickly, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing the Urban Developers, and Joe was just with me representing AOI. Our only point here is a quick one. This is a compromise that the small work group made. This was not in Measure 37. Commercial and industrial interests were not involved in the work group. We have many comments on many parts of this bill, which I think the process will keep us from making, and I'm all right with that. This is one that we really don't like. It restricts all of those particular rights, and it's a compromise made between the cities and some other people in the work group, which we were not asked or involved in. I think there are pieces of this, of Section 14, that are not unrealistic, and I understand where they came from, and had we been consulted and discussed and had this been properly vetted, we may be in a different position. But since the bill came out finally out of the Senate, which this was in, it wasn't in the dash ones, which I sent out to my folks, and then it came out in the dash threes, which you're going to work on, we thought we had to get up and make this objection.
Well, what we'll be able to do, Tom, is if there's a majority feeling on the committee that Section 14 simply would not be put into the dash ones, because we have to work at putting anything from the dash threes that we feel relevant into the dash ones. So
I understand, Mr. Chair, and I also understand and have read through many of the compromises that are here, especially on transferability. We would have other comments and discussions on those, not from the point of view of the land use, but from the point of view of the reality of making some of the developments. Senate Bill 688 passed out of this committee, which was a development agreement type bill and so forth. And I just go on record here that's saying that I would hope that Section 14 would be withdrawn, even though it messes up the compromise. And we will take a look at the bill that you finally put together and see whether or not we can support it, given the fact that you will not have time for the give and take from all of the different groups that were not part of the work group.
Okay. Thank you, Tom, very much.
Representative Ackerman?
Yes, I just want to switch gears a little bit and ask a legal question of Mr. Klein. I'm concerned with the language that says you may not file a claim unless these parameters are met. How do you adjudicate that? Wouldn't it be better to say that it doesn't seem like this would follow the regular claims process of Measure 37 claims?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, any claim, Section 14 ties back into, as well as Section 17 and 18, tied back into the criteria going back in the claims process. And so as part of the scope of the measure under Section 4 and then under the claims process, as the property owner, you would need to demonstrate that you have a claim if the claim that you are filing is for property inside the urban growth boundary and it's for an existing regulation. You would need to demonstrate that you met the criteria of Section 14. If you didn't, then your claim should be denied. So this, in a sense, is incorporated back into those earlier sections.
I'm just worried about the situation where a bureaucrat most may say, well, I look at your application, it doesn't meet these parameters. Section 14 says the claim shall not be filed. End of case. And I don't see how we adjudicate anything. I'm just worried about that scenario.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, the way the application completeness determination provisions are set up, if the government said, you know, based on what you filed, we don't think you have a valid claim, you need to submit something else, the property owner has the right to send a letter back and say, you have everything you're going to get, and then the government has the obligation to now process that claim. The language may not file a claim. I mean, we could tweak that and say we'll not have a claim if that's going to be more comfortable for you. We can certainly change it to make it clear that what we're really talking about here is not the ability to file the piece of paper, but to actually obtain relief.
I just want to make sure that this is adjudicated within the claims process we've already talked about. And again, to do that, the threshold thing is you have to file a claim, and you're not, you know, the language does not allow the claim to be filed. So I do think if you want this within the adjudicative process for Measure 37 claims, we should have some language change here. That's my position. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. On that point, I presume that if an applicant, a claimant, files the form and someone makes a judgment that the claim is for a regulation that's not covered, and dismisses it, that claimant has the same access to the circuit court that anyone else has, and then the circuit court simply looks at the claim form and whatever limited letter the agency sends back saying it's outside the time limits or it's outside the qualified claim bases, and the court says either, yeah, we agree it's outside the allowed claims areas, or it's not, and if they say it's not, then they judge the claim based on the piece of paper that's there, which would probably, in that situation, give an advantage to the claimant because the agency has done no more analysis than whether it's in or out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, certainly the property owner would have the ability to get judicial review. The intention, though, was not that the government would immediately reject the piece of paper and say, oh, wait a minute, you filed something under that doesn't qualify under Section 14 and therefore you can't literally file the claim. The intention was really to say you would not have a claim, that this is part of the criteria, and so we can adjust the language to make it clear that it is processed just like any other claim.
Okay, Glenn, let's move on to Section 15.
Mr. Chair, Section 15 gets into this urban growth study boundary area. It's the part on when Dan Cooper and I were going through this that Dan started to talk about. This section doesn't deal with scope of claims. Instead, what it deals with is the notion that in an area just outside the urban growth boundary, land eventually outside the urban growth boundary, at least some of that land is likely to come inside the urban growth boundary. And when it does, there will be a substantial increase in the value of that property. In addition, it's going to be much more difficult for the urban growth boundaries to expand in the event that there is a significant amount of low-density development that takes place right outside, because now we're going to have to leapfrog over that low-density development. What this section is intended to do is to say that people who are outside urban growth boundaries can still file claims, and they would still have those claims processed, but the effective date of any waiver would be delayed, and it would be delayed until the governments had an opportunity to study how the urban growth boundary should be expanded. And then once a decision was made as to whether to keep property within that study area or to say, no, we're not expanding in that way, once the government has said we're not expanding in that direction, then the waiver becomes effective. But if the government says, you know, we may want to expand in that direction, then the waiver, again, the effective date would be stayed until either a later decision to exclude it or until the year 2015. The purpose for the 2015 was just to give the government sufficient time to expand the urban growth boundary and to give the legislature and the department, LCDC, more time to figure out whether there's a better way to try to deal with urban growth boundary expansions.
Let me ask Director Shetterly at this point. If this is made part of 37, is it going to affect, and I don't know, Lane, maybe you can answer this question, maybe you can't, but there seems cities are going to have a much higher need to perhaps move their urban growth boundaries on a faster, quicker, more responsive type basis. What's your agency's opinion of that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what this does is, frankly, buy time for everyone to figure that out. I mean, recognizing that we're not going to have that solved between now and sine die, by allowing cities and counties together to designate these study areas and then put them in a holding pattern for this period of time, the intent was simply to recognize that, indeed, this is going to have to be rethought. One of the big impacts that Measure 37 has had or will have, I believe, is on urban growth boundaries, this issue of low-density rural development occurring directly adjacent to an urban growth boundary and the difficulty that cities will face ever-urbanizing that kind of development. Those are things that we're going to have to figure out. Rather than, as you can see, there were a lot of issues that had to be addressed in the context of even getting this far, and rather than to try to resolve that thorny issue at the same time, the decision was that this would at least buy sufficient time for the department and for counties and cities and development interests to resolve these future issues around urban growth boundaries.
Okay. Any questions from the committee on 15?
I don't understand.
Other than Representative Greenland?
I can't. I hope there's somebody understands what this says, but I'm having a little trouble with it.
Well, I'm having
Mr. Chair, some of us take information in differently. Some of us like to see words. Some of us like to see numbers. Some of us like to see pictures. This is one where a map, I think, would probably help. Since we're talking about urban growth boundaries, it may help us if we could see how this would actually look on a map of the state. I do have a question before we proceed to that, and I suspect Mr. Shetterly is the right person to answer this. Urban growth boundaries, is there a minimum threshold, minimum size of city before you're required to have an urban growth boundary? How many urban growth boundaries are there in this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, every city has an urban growth boundary.
City of Granite with 25 people.
There's a special, when you think urban, don't think Portland. When you're thinking of urban growth boundary, you think of the delineation of the extension of city services and development. So urban in that context does not mean a dense Portland kind of development. Yes, Granite has an urban growth boundary.
Okay. I would love to be able to see then a map if we could depict this little bubble.
Anyone else on the committee feel that way?
Representative,
yeah,
sure. I also have a question.
Okay, well, I'm just trying to see what the demand is, whether goes to Representative Nolan or whether the entire committee is interested in seeing the map.
Will time permit?
Well, that's a question.
That's always a good question. We're trying to get through this round one this morning, if we can.
One question.
Representative Smith?
Was this section in Measure 37.
Mr. Klein, would you like to answer that question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, this section was not in Measure 37.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Representative Ackerman.
Excuse me.
I did that on purpose.
I know. Okay. That's fine. Okay. Right. You need to share.
Well, my hand
is the nicest part of having.
My hand was up.
My hand. My mouth was up.
I'm having trouble on page 18 with subsection 5. It states, before January 2015 and in lieu of a valid claim for compensation, the owner of property in this area has certain subdivision rights. What's the rationale for that? Or am I reading that correctly? It seems like this thing just pops up with no parameters, and someone can opt out of 37 in return for subdivision rights. And I don't understand it. Maybe I'm not understanding 5. Maybe I don't understand the rationale for it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, what subsection 5 is intended to be is one of those, and I can't remember if we used this word with the committee before, an off-ramp. Something that would give the property owner some of what they could have obtained under Measure 37 without having to go through the entire process of filing the Measure 37 claim. So what this one says is, if you would have had a valid claim, you could subdivide into parcels not smaller than 20 acres, and you wouldn't have to wait. Unlike if you have a valid claim and you get your waiver, this says that the effective date of that waiver is pushed out until you're either outside the study area or until 2015. This would allow the property owner to say, I don't want to wait. I want some development. And so the development would be into parcels not smaller than 20 acres. The reason for the 20 acres is because if you have a house on a 20-acre lot, that is not going to be an impediment to urbanization of that area. if you have a house on 2-acre lots or 5-acre lots, now when urbanization occurs, when the cities expand, they're going to have to leapfrog over a subdivision of 2-acre lots. But if it's a one house per 20 acres, then there wouldn't be that same issue of having to leapfrog over it. So this was just intended as a way to give a property owner something immediate if the property owner wanted to choose that in lieu of filing a Measure 37 claim and waiting until 2015.
But the way this is written, it seems to me you're granting to this landowner more than what he would have received under 37. And that doesn't limit the idea that he would have gotten a subdivision if his valid, if his claim for 37 claim was valid. You just give him the subdivision rights in lieu of a valid claim for compensation, not saying that he could have had this as a permitted use a long time ago. Sounds like a freebie.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, it may have been then poorer word choice on our part. What was intended is, assuming that the property owner could have, at the time they had acquired the property, subdivided down to at least 20-acre lots, then they would be able to do that here. And so this may be a section that we would need to clarify to make it clear that they could only do this if they could have had, if they could have done this at the time that they had acquired the property.
Okay, I think that needs a language change. Otherwise, it seems like a sort of a cousin of the track of record, lot of record thing, where you just have some entitlement to land use without having to worry about a 37 claim. But I appreciate the answer. Thank you.
Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, just before I start, you don't mean, this is one more place where that for compensation should have been deleted by your computer. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, that's correct.
Yeah. My question is, what happens after the, I understand, I think, that if I have a valid claim and now my claim's approved but it's delayed until 2015 or until I'm deemed not in the study area for an urban growth boundary, what happens after 2015 if I am in an urban growth, I'm in an urban growth boundary and I now have a valid claim to do X? Would that be superseded by whatever the regulations of the urban growth boundary would be? Or would I go back into that prior situation of I'm now in an urban growth boundary so I can't have a claim? Or what's the, that's what I don't understand, is what the consequences of this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, if the decision was to expand the urban growth boundary to include your property, then your waiver would never become effective.
So you're now
inside
the waiver.
Right, you're now inside the urban growth boundary and you're subject to those provisions.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, the thinking behind that was that to expand the urban growth boundary and bring property within the urban growth boundary increases its value over and above even a rural subdivision kind of value, that if you're brought in the urban growth boundary, that's like winning the lottery if you're the property owner, because now you've got the expectation ultimately of urbanization, and just the act of bringing property into an urban growth boundary will substantially increase it in its value. So property owners in that respect can expect to recoup the value of their property by the action of the local government in bringing it within the urban growth boundary.
I see. I guess I did understand it.
Thank you. Any other questions in regarding Section 15? Okay, we move on to, as you can see, Committee 16 was deleted. So we move to 17.
Mr. Chair, if I might suggest, if I understand your schedule, you have about 10 minutes.
Right around there, but we're not, you know, the stroke of 10 will probably turn into pumpkins or something like that.
My suggestion, if it's okay with the chair, is that we skip over 17 and 18, which I think are going to be longer conversations for you, and try to deal with the balance of this, because the balance of this, I think, is going to be less controversial than 17 and 18.
Okay.
Section 19 is a conforming amendment. Back in Section 7, we said that a property owner could, as part of a Measure 37 claim, also file a land use application. They could file them jointly. What Section 19 does is to make a conforming amendment to the LUBA jurisdictional statute to say, if the property owner does that, here's what LUBA gets to hear, here's what the court gets to hear. That's all Section 19 is intended to do. If you don't have Section 7 in the bill, you don't need Section 19 in the bill.
Okay. Any questions on
Section 19. Seeing none, let's go to 20.
Section 20 is another conforming amendment. Back in Section 4 of the bill, there's a provision that says the Department of Administrative Services would adopt rules that would help flesh out how an appraisal would be done for a Measure 37 claim and would include the opportunity for an appraiser, rather than doing a full-blown appraisal, to provide something called a statement of reduction in value. Section 20 is a conforming amendment to tell the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board to also authorize appraisers to do that. And that change is on page 23. Appraisers are licensed by the state. They can only undertake those actions that the state has authorized. This is intended to say that they would be authorized to do these statements of reduction. That's all Section 20 does.
Any questions on Section 20?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Donovan.
Does the licensure board or statute, does the licensure board by rule or does the statute tell the appraisers how to make that calculation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, the statute would not tell the appraisers how to do that. What we were envisioning is that administrative rules would be adopted, because that's going to be a, you know, let's get some, you know, try to adopt the administrative rules, let's get some experience, revise the rules, to really figure it out. So the statutes don't say that. It would be an administrative rule. What the statutes say, and what the statutes say to the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board, adopt rules to tell the appraisers what they can and cannot do. What they can do right now is to issue appraisals. They can't issue things called statement of reductions. This says, licensure board, change your rules to allow them to issue statements of reduction.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, if I may follow up.
Follow up.
Appraisals now are used for different reasons than this calculation of a reduction in value is used.
Oh, that's right.
An appraisal might be used by someone to decide whether now is the right time to sell, or if they're in a contested issue, you have competing appraisals. And there are mechanisms in the rules now that kind of bring them toward a common ground, if you will. What's the mechanism that you envision to make sure that you don't end up with appraisers who get a reputation for being either particularly generous or particularly stingy in conducting these calculations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, let me answer that question this way. Those standards that the appraisers currently follow is something called, and I just remember the acronym USPAP. It's like Uniform Standards for Professional Appraisals, something like that. They're actually, I believe, federal standards, not state standards. And those don't deal with these reductions in value. In order to try to ensure that we don't have different appraisers using wildly different approaches, what we're envisioning and what the bill in Section 4, and you haven't gone through Section 4 yet, but in Section 4 it would say that the Department of Administrative Services should adopt administrative rules to say, and here's how those statements of reduction in value would work, to try to make sure that you don't have wildly different approaches. So it would be administrative rules adopted by DAS as we have been contemplating it.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions on Section 20?
I just have one quick one.
Smith?
Is there a timeline for them to adopt the rules, administrative rules?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, there is nothing specific in the bill right now that says they have to adopt rules by X date.
Okay, thank you.
Seeing no other questions, we'll move on to Section 21.
That's an easy one.
No.
Mr. Nothing Chair, perhaps we should move on to Section 22.
No objection. 21.
Section 22 and 24 are both related. Mm-hmm. What they're intended to do is to say to a property owner that if you come to the government and ask that the government change your designation in the comprehensive plan to, in essence, upzone it, or to change your zoning to upzone it, or that you come to the government and say, I want to become part of the city, and so please annex me to the city, that in that circumstance, the property owner should agree to abide by the rules that are in effect when that action happens. Without that, there's at least the argument that if I'm the property owner and I ask that my property, I've owned my property since 1960, and I ask that my property be rezoned from residential to commercial, and let's say the government does that. And in 1990, the government, the city, had adopted some restriction related to commercial property. My property is now zoned commercial. I've owned my property since 1960. There's at least an argument that I can file a Measure 37 claim that says, government, you either have to compensate me for that restriction you imposed 10 years ago, or you have to waive it. The notion here is that if I'm coming to the government saying, please rezone my property to commercial, that I ought to have to agree to live with the regulations in effect when that happens. And so that would be true whether it's a comprehensive plan, a zone change, or in Section 24, annexation. That's what those provisions are intended to do. These would only be invoked in the event that the property owner applied to the government to have something done.
So in essence, we're talking about Section 21 through 24 at this point.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any questions on those sections?
Representative, how does that same argument apply to annexations?
Forced annexations.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, if an individual applies to the government to be annexed, so right then, use myself as an example, I live outside the city, I've owned my property since 1960, and I now apply and I get annexed to a city. The city adopted some regulations, let's say, 5 years ago or 10 years ago, and I say, well, I've owned my property prior to the city's adoption of those regulations, therefore, city, waive those regulations. Mm-hmm. The rationale here is to say, if I'm asking the city to make me a part of the city, I ought to agree to the regulations that the city has in effect when I annex. And so that's what Section 24 is intended to do. And the reference to the Boundary Commission is simply because in Lane County, it's not the local governments that could require this. It's only the Boundary Commission.
I think the only thing I don't see, and I think it's implicit in your answer, is that the request for a zone change or annexation affects property for which I have a Measure 37 claim. You don't say that, but I think that's what you mean. Am I correct?
You are correct, Mr. Ackerman.
Okay. I think maybe that clarification should be there. It's one of these things that pops up without reference, and again, I'm worried what happens at the local level when someone comes in for a zone change on property that does not involve a 37 claim. They have to waive any 37 claims they have. I think that should be tied up.
Okay, we'll move on to Section 25. 26.
Does it seem to mean that any other kind of annexation, this isn't true?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, this would not speak to what happens with the forced annexation.
Okay,
Mr. Chair, Section 25 is one of those sort of legislative council. We just got to say what these sections apply to, and that would be a good one to take up when you go back to Section 1 and decide, are you going to have the March 15th date or are you not going to have the March 15th date? Section 26 is a provision that says if somebody applied for waivers from the county and the state, applied prior to March 15th, it related to a single tract, it involved state and county regulations, and waivers were approved by both the county and the state prior to June 1, then those waivers are transferable. If you recall from last week, what I had said is if somebody applies before March 15th and chooses not to withdraw their claim and refile under the new provisions, then they don't get the benefit of the new provisions. So somebody normally who had filed prior to March 15th and got a waiver would not get the benefit of Section 13 on transferability. They can only get that benefit if they refiled under the new measure. What Section 26 does is to say, under limited circumstances, somebody would, their waiver would be transferable. Back when I said that to you a week ago, the only one I was aware of was Dorothy English. I don't know if there are any more since then. And Lane says no. So this provision basically would say that the waivers granted to Dorothy English would be transferable under Section 13, and that's all Section 26 would do.
Any questions in that regard? Okay, Lynn, thank you. Committee, it will be our intention this afternoon to start with Section 17 and that will complete our first round, and then we'll go back to the beginning and we will start deciding what goes into 3120 and what doesn't. And we say we'll have a discussion on every motion, and if we can't find a general consensus, then we will have a vote on each one. So
are we back in this room?
Yes.
We're back here in room B, and we'll meet again at 1:15 this afternoon, or if the floor session goes longer, 15 minutes after the House adjourns the floor session. So we can't thank you gentlemen enough.
No, thank you.
For your time and your efforts here. And for those that keep coming in every day, we really appreciate you being here, because we just never know as we go along where we might need your input. So we thank each and every one of you for being here. We'll see you at 1:15. We are adjourned until a recess until 1:15.